Welcome to AI and Journalism, the podcast where we empower journalists, communicators, educators, and other media professionals to navigate the world of artificial intelligence with integrity. I'm Yumi Wilson, your host, and in each episode, we'll explore practical ways you can use AI to boost productivity, stay creative, and maintain the ethical standards that our industries demand. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, this is your space to learn how AI can enhance your work without losing your voice. Let's get started. Welcome to AI in Journalism, the podcast for journalists and media pros looking to make AI work for them without getting lost in tech. I'm your host, Yumi Wilson, bringing you practical insights from industry leaders to help future-proof your career. Picture a social network driven not by beach photos or selfies, but by breaking news. Today, as part of our startup series, we're diving into InPress, a platform connecting people through meaningful story-driven engagement. My guest, Adam Harder, co-founder of InPress, shares how AI is transforming social connections through the stories that matter most, redefining not only how news is shared, but also how we relate to one another. For journalists and media pros, this isn't just a tech talk. It's a firsthand look at how AI can revolutionize newsroom efficiency, build meaningful connections, and engage audiences in ways traditional social media can't. If you want to stay ahead of the curve and see how AI is shaping the future of news and digital communities, this episode is for you. Adam, welcome to AI in Journalism.
Thank you so much, Yumi. What a wonderful introduction that was. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is an honor to have you. We met at the recent O&A conference, which was huge, thousands of people gathering, and AI was the main topic.
It was great too. I don't know about you, but that was my first O&A. So I didn't know what to expect coming into there. I went in with a sort of empty, hopeful, optimistic mind and left really inspired. Everyone who I met, including you, such experienced industry experts. There was so much excitement and embrace of innovation, which coming from my journalistic background and like military media was just a nice change of pace. So it was really inspiring to be around everyone and meet you.
Well, thank you for saying that. And you know, the two words that stopped me and I have to ask about military media. What is that?
I was a military broadcast journalist for 6 years. I started at the age of 20 when I was in my junior year of university at Kent State University in Ohio. I was a broadcast journalist undergrad, but you know, I grew up in Ohio, in rural Ohio, and I didn't grow up with a lot of economic opportunity. I would say I got to about sophomore junior year of college and realized that that job at Pita Pit and Express wasn't going to cover the bills anymore. So I had to find more drastic measures to continue my education. And I walked into an Air Force recruiter's office. To my surprise, they had broadcast journalism as a career. And they said, yeah, you can audition for this. And if you get it, we can guarantee you that job. And I went for it, you know. And it's funny, I use the example of, you know, Good Morning Vietnam or Full Metal Jacket. Those are probably examples that people are familiar.
Some of my favorite movies, by the way.
Yeah, but it was great. I mean, I make a joke that I say the two best decisions I ever made were getting into the Air Force and getting out of the Air Force. Because, as you know, this is a portfolio-based business. And I was able to be stationed overseas for all six of those years in Guam, Korea, and Belgium, and just cover an incredible breadth of wild military travel and just like celebrity interview stories. And so by the time I got out at 26, it afforded me a lot of opportunities. I didn't have any debt. They paid for all of my degrees, including my master's at Newhouse at Syracuse, which is where I had the idea for InPress. So I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now if it wasn't for that. But yeah, that is where it all started.
So many things that you said just resonate deeply with me, because that was my dream. When I signed up for the Associated Press after college, I was like, I am going to become a foreign correspondent and travel everywhere. So that really hit home, like being able to go to places like Korea and Belgium. And the other thing that resonates is just my father was in the Army for 26 years. So, you know, there's always a synergy in how people connect and how stories are told. So just wanted to share that with you.
That's great. That's great. What, out of curiosity, what did he do?
He was a medic in the Army. And then he turned that into a career as a registered nurse after he retired in his 40s. It's so funny because when I was a kid, I was like, that's so old. And now I'm like, oh, that's very, very young.
I know.
All right. So let's talk about InPress. It's a platform focused on news connections rather than lifestyle content. That's at least what I have heard about it. But tell me more. What's the platform about? And also, let's talk about your vision. How did it come together?
Yeah. So I alluded to my education at Newhouse through my master's in journalism innovation there. And that's where it all started. The thesis assignment for that degree was to solve a problem in the media with technology. And this was in 2016. Now, granted, I founded InPress in 2023, but originally I had the idea back then. And I was stationed overseas in Belgium. I was active duty. Had no network, had no money. I didn't have any means of like being an entrepreneur, right? But frankly, or what it's like to be a quote unquote civilian, i.e. a normal American civilian person. So, but the fact of the matter is that the technology didn't exist at the time. I had also started because I thought in 2016, you know, I use this silly example, but it's true. I was naive. I thought back then in 2015, like, wow, think about like Snapchat and Facebook and all these great ways that we can communicate with other people, see different cultures and recognize that no matter where people come from or their walk of life, like, everyone's really just a human at the end of the day. And I thought this would naturally sort of progress our entire species to a more like liberal democratic order and everyone will be more empathetic in the future. And then 2016 came around and I was like, wow, what a what a naive, adorable little journalist I was at the age of 24. And that was a surprise. And it's ironic that, you know, my master's thesis in journalism innovation semester was the 2016 election. It was that same time. And I think that's when I realized, well, I was wrong. I guess I had seen that instead of social necessarily just being this place that would always propagate facts and connection and culture, it was very easy to manipulate and basically pull the wool over people's eyes with objective nonsense because some of their friends or people that they trust shared objective nonsense, and that basically, that was winning the attention battle over objective fact. And I was just basically thinking, like, facts are losing. You know, how can we make factual information win in the attention battles? It's never going to win on its face, right? Like, recommender systems with clickbait and rage bait that always agrees with us and oversimplifies complex issues to blame on everyone else, you know, that's delicious. It just fits right in there. But that's unfortunately not reality. And facts often suck. They don't agree with us, but they are what they are. That's why they have value. And so I just thought, we're not going to, just by posting more like, you know, factual content on news feeds, that's never going to work. But maybe if we use factual information as the conduit for something more universal that everybody needs, regardless of their political background, culture, location, then it could work. And that thing that I chose to focus on was community and friendship and love. So using that factual journalism and how people think and feel and care about it to inform a very detailed version of someone's personality portfolio that we can match them with others on. Now, it was a great idea and so far as the theory, but again, the technology didn't really work. Back in 2016, we would have had to rely on a lot of just like repetition. There was no machine learning. And like I said, I didn't have any money or network. So I kind of just forgot about it. It's like, cool, I got a good grade and went on with my life and got out of the military. And then last year in 2023, January, I was laying in bed and literally jumped out of bed, scaring my fiance half to death because my ADHD brain had a strike of inspiration. I was like, wait, that idea I had in 2016, that would actually work way better now with large language models. That would be the tool that could efficiently draw conclusions from all those different keywords and topics we scrape and more accurately and scalably figure out someone's subconscious interests and passions and infer those that connective tissue to bring people together.
Wow. Hold on one second here. The brain. Have you seen that movie, A Beautiful Mind?
Yes, I have.
Because I just want our listeners to know, because your mind is bringing, it's like synopsis of the cell, of the, you know, at the molecular level, you're saying that in 2016, you had this idea, yet really the technology wasn't quite there. And all of a sudden in 2023, when things really start heating up in the AI space, the brain once again says, wait a minute, this is the perfect time to bring that idea that you had in 2016 to fruition. What did that look like? And you're telling your fiance.
I like got up and I wrote something down on the side table. And she's like, what are you doing? I don't know. I have to look into this in the morning. I filter in the morning. And to be fair, she's British. So she tells it like it is, right? That's typical British culture. And she would tell me if it wasn't a good idea. And she actually, despite having no background in media, was like, I would actually use that. That's kind of interesting. I was like, great. That's a ringing endorsement from a British person. I'll take that. So I started looking.
There's hope.
Right, exactly. I started looking into it. I thought, surely somebody had done this by now. And it turns out nobody had. So I basically looked into a patent and started building what would be the beginning. I actually just went to Figma and I was like, okay, how would this actually work? Like, what would the onboarding look like? What would the actual interface work? Luckily for me, I was working as leading video marketing teams for different tech companies at that time. And so a lot of my friends at work were all developers. And so it's not like I've never written a line of code in my life, right? I'm not a developer. I never claimed to be, but I just luckily knew a lot.
Well, that's actually encouraging. Listeners, this is good for all of us to hear, because I think so much of it has been, oh, I don't know code. I don't know how to do these things. So I can't do this myself. I can't do a startup. I can't start that new career. And what I'm hearing, Adam, is we're in a new world, right? If you have a great idea, you pursue it. And if you need help, you ask for it from various people. And yes, it's important to have that background and experience, but no, it shouldn't stop you.
I think it's more about a vision. You know, you'll find a lot in entrepreneurship, and I didn't know this at the time when I started, but there are a lot of people out there who will, everyone knows more than you on something. And when you're starting if you're doing a truly innovative idea, you're pursuing a new vision, there's not really a playbook for it. So you kind of just have to be a mixture of crazy and brave and insane to just go for it. The thing is that in this case, there's a lot of folks who are fantastic developers who will be on networks like Y Combinator, Co-Founder Matching, which is where I found my co-founder, who have all the development skills, but they just don't have the idea. They're like maybe if someone comes along and inspires me with an interesting idea, I'd be happy to build it for them, but I just don't know where to avert my, like to put my attention and my skills.
Okay, hold on a second. What did you just mention? We need that as a resource. I'm going to put it in the show notes. What's that place where you went?
So Y Combinator is an accelerator. I would argue it's probably the most famous, well-known, hard to get into accelerator in America. I think that's probably a fair thing to say, but they have a co-founder matching tool, which funnily enough is kind of like a dating app in and of itself. Like you build a profile and you say, hey, I'm Adam. I've got this crazy idea for a news-based dating and friends app. This is how I think it would work. These are my interests. These are my passions. And then, you know, basically people will, you'll say, I'm looking for a technical co-founder.
Hook up.
And then, yeah, kind of business hookup, right? And then co-founders, someone who wants to be a CTO, where I'm like, I'm looking for a full stack developer. This is how the app needs to work. And so other people who have the technical skills who are looking for a CEO, in this case, me, we'll start looking and reaching out. And if it's a match, then you reach out to each other and say, hey, I would love to talk and just like pick your brain. And I think a lot of people have said that it didn't work well for them, but I found it to be amazing. I mean, I found my current co-founder from it and it was great. So it's kind of like found my co-founder for a news-based dating app on what is essentially an entrepreneurship dating app.
All right. So they work. So far, so good.
So far, so good. And actually, it's funny, now that Impress has only been launched for about 8 weeks, but we're already getting our success stories too, which we can get to in a bit. But all this to say, that's how it came together. And that was a year and a half ago about, I want to say. And it is a very complex thing that we're building, right? It's basically three apps in one. It's got a sort of news aggregation function, which is a net new way of delivering journalism in an app. And then it's also got this matchmaking function, which is very heavy on the back end. And then it's also, you know, got messaging, almost like Facebook Messenger. So it's combining that all into one app with a small team and a budget that I was bootstrapping took a year and a half. And now 2 months ago, we launched it. And I've met you right after that.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, to have a budget, a limit, right? Resources, staff, all of that, just a year and a half. I mean, that seems like a pretty short time to go from conception or vision to implementation. And you said 8 weeks ago, this app launched. So that leads me to, curiosity speaking now, what is happening in those 8 weeks? What has it been like?
It has been a wild journey. You'll get a lot of interesting advice when you are an entrepreneur. Most of it's good. Some of it you can do away with. But one of the ones that I think really stuck is that when you launch a product, especially a network-based product, think like Uber, Tinder, Facebook, you don't want to over iterate on features and assume that you know exactly how your users are going to want to use it or what features are going to be really important to them. Because what you'll end up doing is you're just delaying. You have to get to market. Like, it's more valuable to get to market and be the one who consumes that space than it is to even get a bunch of patents and create the idea. Like, just get it to market and learn and iterate. And so that's kind of what we've done. Is in that time, you know, we took it to market, seen initial success and really interesting engagement, and people are actually matching and they're telling us about it. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But now it's like, okay, cool. We're out there. Take a step back. What's all the feedback we're getting? Tighten this screw and, you know, strengthen this foundation. Let's start iterating on this feature that we've heard a bunch of requests for. So yeah, so we're launched in DC. That's how you launch a network-based app. There's this book I recommend to anyone who's ever curious launching a network-reliant company. It's called The Cold Start Problem. And that's kind of the cold start problem is the ability to take a network and a company that starts from zero users to scale with many, many users. Because if you think about like a Facebook, if there was no users on Facebook, it wouldn't have any value. Nobody would go on there and be able to talk to anyone. The advertisers wouldn't be buying anything. It wouldn't make any sense. So that's a tough thing to kind of get to cruising altitude. But that's why you start in one place. In our case, we chose Washington, D.C., because let's be honest, where would you launch a news-based dating app in America? The idea is that you launch it in a finite space, you get it sticky with that community, you learn, you improve, you use your performance metrics to get the funding to continue to expand. Because I use the example that if, God forbid, we launched it in D.C. and it just took off, you know, we're a small team with a small budget at first. And our servers would have melted, you know, like we would, or all the issues that would have come up, we wouldn't have the staff to address them. So you just start small and let yourself kind of expand outwards. And that's where we are now.
Absolutely. So it's kind of, you're getting real people to, in a sense, use the product, but also test it out and help make it better, which I think is similar to, you know, the launching of many of these AI tools that, you know, are collecting data, but we're getting some value from it. But I've seen so many iterations, you know, just alone on ChatGPT, for example, when I started in 2023 to what we're doing now, every time I'm using it, it's like, oh, they've changed that. And it's like they're listening. And I think users of any type of app or platform would appreciate that. So that's good to know.
Yeah, you'll get feedback that you just do not anticipate. Some of the features that we've iterated on have been fascinating. And they've just been, I'm glad we didn't over iterate at launch and that we're like kind of have our ear to the ground right now and just listening to users. Because like some of the more interesting features that we're implementing now from user feedback would be the idea that when you match with people, well, this is a normal feature on Impress, but when you match with someone on Impress, we will show you what your subconscious top shared interests are upfront. So it's not like Facebook or even Flipboard where you can say, I'm into this thing, I'm not into this thing. You never really get to say that. We just ask you at a very high level based on news content, how did this article make you feel, right? In emojis, how interesting and how important is it to you out of five? And we basically have you rate things at a very, very high level and let the backend algorithm with all the keywords and topics and the AI infer pretty accurately and quickly what those subconscious things are that make you tick. And that's the conduit for the matching, which is why people come to Impress. It's more genuine and authentic.
I love that. Yeah, because, you know, the thing is, it's so hard not to lie when you're filling out these forms. And you know, I remember back in the day when I was doing online dating, it was kind of like, oh, do you want to be at the beach? Or do you like sunsets?
Who doesn't like a sunset?
Right?
The thing that we get told a lot is to focus, but users are like, you should focus on the subconscious aspect of it. Because while it's really nice to have control over certain aspects of our online lives, it's also having so much control that builds echo chambers around us. That's why our news feed doesn't just show you more news that it thinks you want to see, like Facebook or Apple News. It works like an old school newspaper. Everyone in the local area sees the same articles on a given day, and you can choose to read and not read what you want. And it's funny, by the way, how folks have said, we've talked to like younger Gen Z users. I was presenting at Newhouse and also New School here in Manhattan recently. And I would say that they're like, wait, I've used Impress. I don't understand how this newsfeed, this is so interesting. I've never used a newsfeed like this. It's like, it's actually just called a newspaper. Like back in the day, we used to have these things where everyone got the same news on a day and picked it. That's like, whoa. Like, so, you know, now we're like re-innovating with classic newspapers, but all this to say, by kind of taking the control out of people's hands, they actually have, we've found so far in our users, they appreciate that because they're so used to having everything tailored to them that there's almost seems to be this sort of I don't even know if it's industry or societal pushback against being spoon-fed stuff, that they just want to have some critical thinking autonomy. And that actually for us, when it comes to matchmaking people, allowing them to do that is more efficient and accurate when it comes to the data for matching them with others anyways. So it's good for media literacy. It's good for the user's ability to make their own decisions and frankly feel like an adult and not just be like doom scrolling mindlessly. And it's also better for our ability to find the right person for them.
Since we brought up the newspaper and news, how do you choose the stories? Do you work with certain newsrooms?
First off, every outlet that is on Impress, we make sure that it has to be within a certain neutrality range and above a minimum reliability. And we work with AdFontes to do that. AdFontes is a third-party research firm who has an army of researchers whose whole job is to determine that in aggregate for an outlet. So we set pretty strict parameters, and any outlets that fall within that we'll work with. Now we have a third-party aggregator as well where we'll source that content from. And so far, in about 2 months, it's about 450 outlets, I want to say. We're also actively talking to outlets for partnerships. ONA was interesting because it really got us out there as far as getting interest from other journalists. And I just had a meeting today with, I won't, out of respect for them, I won't say which outlet, but...
I'll be Connie Chung. You can whisper it in my ear.
I'll just say that it's probably a top 10 outlet in America. And either they reached out to us. We didn't reach out to them. They're like, hey, we've heard what you're building in with Impress. This data sounds fascinating. Would you like to have our content on Press? And I'll tell them, that would be amazing. We just can't have paywalls because we can't have our users rating articles they can't read. And also remove the ads because I'd like to say we're a matchmaking app that features news, not a news app that features matchmaking. So we have this sort of responsibility to maintain a vibe and accessibility. And they're usually, they're cool with that because they want to know how people think and feel and care about everything that they write. And I should also say that this is anonymized data. So we're never giving up names or emails, but that doesn't even really matter here because they could find out how, a 27-year-old African-American male in Northeast DC, the emotions they feel about sustainability, how interested are they in particular types of wool production, right? I'm just making things up right now. It could be anything that's ever covered in the news, which is just very interesting. Or to the point where like which topics or which articles are creating the most matches. Like you could tell a journalist, hey, you wrote an article about, transportation policy and it made this many people fall in love. It's just like such a weird sort of data metric. So
that is so mind-blowing in a way, right? Because we're looking at news from the perspective of those who are hoping to fall in love or at least have a great connection. So it's almost like there's a motive involved in the pursuit of news. And so I wonder, and I want to just clarify, you're saying that if a newsroom or newspaper news organization says, okay, we will allow you to have our content for free. I'm assuming you don't pay them.
Right. No, we don't pay them.
Okay. So for free, and we will not put in behind a paywall and we will not put ads on it. If they do that, do they have access to the data that shows who's reading their content?
Yes. So we actually are building out that database right now. We're looking at a tool called ClickHouse. We also use Mixpanel. These are two different sort of data visualization tools. And what we're doing is giving our outlet partners the ability to basically dig into it because it changes every day by the second. This isn't like a single Nielsen report. Because the more users rate, the better their matches become. They're motivated to keep doing it. So that's why when I looked at the metrics this morning, right, we're in the thousands of users, but we already have like 20,000 article ratings just in those the thousands of users in DC alone in 8 weeks because they're incentivized to keep doing it. So it's just like so much engagement. That's why I think so at that point, what I'm trying to say is it's not like a beast we can tame. And that's the point. It's like the chaos theory of non-inferential data. And the other reason that they're interested in it, and I'll use an example that the head of data science at the Washington Post used with me, which is the reason that it's interesting to journalists is because like if let's say the Washington Post is to share an article on Facebook, it might get a lot of likes, but what does a like mean? But you could like things for a lot of reasons, but the idea that they can basically get to the crux of emotion and interest and importance of all of these different demographic types, because it is a connections app and you do have to, reveal some of your gender, location and stuff if you're ever going to expect to get a match. So yeah, so it's all out there and it's just been really interesting for outlets. I think they're really intrigued by this. something that's interesting, which I didn't foresee, I should have foreseen it, admittedly, I probably should have seen this coming, is that we had a user reach out to us. This is just one user, but I guess I'll say that if somebody reaches out cold and tells a company that they're liking their product, bless them. I would never think to do that. But I would like to think that if that one person is doing that, that it's probably indicative of a wider experience that a lot of people are having and just not raising. But she had mentioned, she was like, hey, I opened up my Times app this morning to read the news and I saw this article, but then I thought, wait, I'm not getting anything out of this. So I closed it and I opened up Impress instead because I could find the topic there and actually get matched for it. Like, it's the changing user behavior so that they can get something else out of it.
Well, and it sounds like, I mean, if you can do two things at once, well, it's saving time. And that's, you know, I think one of the things that AI tools are doing for so many people is increasing efficiency in our own lives so that we can get a number of things done. It's almost, you know, becoming superhuman in a way. But getting back to what you had said about this data being very important so that newsrooms can understand their readers, newsrooms, listeners, and viewers can understand. So it's not just print or digital, it's television and radio, all spectrum. But the focus group used to be the thing that newsrooms, I used to work at the Chronicle in San Francisco, and it was, I remember the focus groups coming in and kind of giving, you know, us feedback on what they'd like to see more. And it always felt weird, you know, it's kind of like, wait, it's just four or five people or, you know, 10 people telling us. And now it sounds like you've come up with a system. And I'm assuming that it's based on machine learning and generative, or how is it created to be able to go through all of this content and then make sense of it from a subconscious level?
I'll put it this way. I can't go into exact coding. I can't go into certain specs for, you know, proprietary information, but what I can say is that you kind of already just said it right there. It's basically what we're doing is generative. It is large language model. It is identifying some of those keywords in those articles. And at scale, it's using things like repetition, your ratings, and other interactions that the user has to draw out what you would essentially just call weightiness of importance, right? Like if maybe you're reading more articles about rollerblading than you are about surfing, you know, whoever you are, maybe you live in Venice Beach, California in that example. But that's how we can infer, okay, sure. So yeah, you're reading more about rollerblading, but what are the emotions and interest and importance around that? What are the other things in the rollerblading articles? Is it the locations? Is it the atmospheres, the weather? Like there's so many other things it's so much data, especially because if you think about it, like the example I'll use is that because you can rate multiple emojis. Let's just say you said you felt three different feelings on an article plus the two other metrics I've described. And maybe in an average article, there's 3,000 words. And so maybe 200 of those are actually words that the type of words we would identify. Well, you just gave us 5x sentiment analysis on 200 words. That's 1,000 insights per article. It doesn't take us long to identify your core interests, but it also, doing it this way, is quicker to identify your weird periphery interests. I want to know how you feel about a random indie band. I want to know how you feel about Nepal. Like if I was to continually just show you echo chamber information, I'll probably never get there. But if I just put everyone at net neutral factual journalism in the middle, everyone starts at net zero. It's easier to figure out what makes them different and unique.
So now I want to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about practical advice for journalists. You know, for journalists and communicators tuning in right now, since you do have so much knowledge and understanding of where we are, not just in terms of AI, but in terms of where we are as a society and the potential that we have to do good things, I think. But saying all that is, what AI tools would you recommend to boost their workflow?
So first things first, I'll say that, and this is going to be the sure knee-jerk answer that everybody gives you, Claude or ChatGPT, simply in that, like, yes, we're building all these new AI tools, but we're still using AI every day. I pay for the company for those tools because to your point, they drive efficiency. I'd like to think that finally, a lot of the conversations that I've been having with different journalism scholars and journalists in the field is that I'm confident and optimistic that we're not making the same mistakes with AI that would have been done with, say, Web3 or even the advent of the internet, right? I spoke to a leader of the Knight Foundation the other day who was like, he's like, I remember in the 80s when I was a reporter and somebody said, ah, the web's going to be a fad. And so we didn't do anything for it at his outlet. And it's like that kind of thing where it's like, it's dismissive and it's like, oh, it's never going to touch us. The fact is that every new technical innovation, if it touches communication, will affect journalism. And I think I'll get back to the technologies here in a moment, but I guess my bigger point here, something that I've been speaking with them recently, is that we've come to this realization together that historically, journalists, I think at any given point, were often the most well-read person in the room. But that also can come with a certain amount of confidence, elitism, and exclusionary thinking that makes us think that we have to protect our work at all costs and build a moat around it. But if we do that, then we're losing because the rest of the world keeps innovating whether we join them or not. And at a certain point, if we don't innovate fast enough with them, we have to play by their rules. Whereas if we are actually innovating alongside them, finding ways to embrace technology to bolster our own industry, we get to write the rules and actually do what's good for journalism and ethical journalism instead of having a case where a social network like one of the big boys back in the early 2010s, journalists outlets just kind of had to try to shoehorn factual journalism into algorithmic models that only perpetuate quick dopamine hits, which doesn't really facilitate depth. And therefore, factual journalism doesn't thrive there. So it's kind of like, let's just get ahead of it and embrace the technology, because I promise you that the fear and discomfort that you feel right now of adapting is going to be a lot better than the fear and discomfort you feel when you have no choice but to play by the rules because you were complacent. That would be my advice to journalists.
Absolutely. And just to build on that, you know, what I learned from some of the other guests on this podcast, one is that part of the reason why factual journalism doesn't show up in a lot of social or public places is because advertisers don't want, like, let's say they don't want violent content, for example. So then all of a sudden that is kind of weighed out. You know, those type of stories are kicked out of the algorithm that's being used to produce the type of content that we see on a website or feed, for example. So it sounds like in press is a place where someone could go and not worry that they're not seeing everything, that they would get to see stories about crime, they would see stories about war, they would see stories that are not just the good ones.
They would see stories about Adele in the culture section. They would see everything. You know, I mean, who knows? It depends on the editor. We have four different editors. It depends on what they pick. But that's kind of the point, though, right? Is that there is this, more so than I probably would have anticipated when we started in press, there seems to be this, like I said, this kind of like want or thirst from people to just get what they need and be done with it. Especially because, sure, it's best for us because we are a product where what really the outcome that most users come for is the connections at the end of the funnel. The news is often the means to the end. In this particular case, just happens to be factual. And that's kind of, I'll just be open, more like Trojan horsing media literacy into people because we're giving them a big universal outcome and they just happen to be reading Reuters, whether they know what Reuters is or not, for example. But the idea that they can get what they need and be like, okay, you know, I learned a couple things today. I'm gonna go on to the other thing that I want. And I feel like that's just objectively as a journalist good for people. Like I'll be the first as a journalist to say, like, if I read too much news, it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing to be like addicted to news all the time. Like news can be pretty rough and can put you in a dark place if you're just, especially in doom scrolling recommender systems that just perpetuate more and more of, just solidify your views around an idea, whether or not it's correct. So we're very smart creatures. I think a lot of us can see what that's doing to us. And so this sort of giving the user the control has been well received, more so than I probably would have thought. You will have a lot of people like VCs or even sometimes other journalists who will say things to me like, well, why not just keep giving them more of what they want to see? I've even had people ask, like, what if I would just want my nonsensical, like unfactual information? And I tell them, like, this isn't the place for you. And it's not just because it's unethical for us and why we founded this company, but it's also because it would be bad for the data. I use the example that the reason we use factual journalism on Impress is because if I show you an article that says water is wet, I show someone else an article that says water is wet, but there's too much of it because of Democrats. And the third person, water is wet, but there's not enough because of Republicans. And I ask those three people what emotions they feel. They're going to rate that sentiment analysis wildly differently, despite the fact that really it's all just about water being wet. And so it actually is worse for the outcomes. So no, we built this in a way that basically, if we were to ever deviate from our neutral ethics in article selection and outlet vetting, it would actually damage the product. So that accountability is kind of built into the system.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And if I can just also add why it's important to see all the news and not just the stuff you want to see. From my own experience in 2016 and that year leading up to it, I think I was programming my Facebook account to just show stories from friends who shared them that I wanted to see. And so when the election turned out the way it did, I was shocked. And I'm not alone. But it was a lesson for me, and I've tried very hard on social media to leave the algorithm as open as possible, not liking or disliking content because maybe it doesn't agree with my opinion, because then I end up being in a smaller bubble. And already living in the Bay Area, I'm in a bubble. So I just don't want to be a bubble. I want to know what's really going on.
There's this advent too. You'll hear, I'm sure you hear this sometimes. I've definitely heard it for years in journalism, which is, people who will be like, you know what? I don't know that I want to be reminded of what's factual. I go ahead and I read articles from all over the political spectrum and I discern what the fact is. And I always respond to that. I'm like, first off, why do you want to put yourself through that? It's pretty bad indictment on the industry at large if that's what you feel like you need to do to discern what fact is. There are journalists out there, like I define accountable journalism as, are you writing a story and will you lose your job for factual inaccuracy? That's accountability, right? Like, and so I just feel like there's a lot of folks out there who think that they need to overcompensate to figure out where the truth is. And I don't necessarily think that that's true, but I also don't think that, I'm not going to say, there are other like aggregators who are doing good work in so far as showing what the political leanings are or the biases and narratives of different stories, but they're still showing everything, whether it's factual or not. They'll just say, this has a leans this way, this leans that way. And I don't really honestly find that helpful either. Like it's good to know, but at the end of the day, you're still showing nonsense. Like I think the more efficient way of just doing this is just don't elevate nonsense. just elevate accountable journalism.
That could be a slogan.
Yes, honestly. Like, besides our slogan that media literacy is sexy, right? Yeah.
Yes, which I do have the bag, folks out there in the listener world. Yes, Adam has an amazing bag that says media literacy is sexy. It's black with white letters. A must have. I don't know if you have any more.
We've been getting requests to actually open up a web store. I was literally talking to my team about it today. I was like, guys, I wore this hat that I have on. It says the same thing. It's like a dad cap that says media literacy is sexy. And I got stopped 3 times yesterday where I live in Brooklyn. And folks asked me, where did you get that? Or, oh, I'm doing my PhD in media literacy. Where can I buy that? And I'm like, we should just sell these things because I feel like people actually want them.
I would say, yeah. And yeah. And you know, media literacy, it's interesting. I've been teaching journalism, various forms of journalism and broadcasting and all that for 20 plus years. And I remember there was a long period of time, no one really even thought about media literacy. It was a given. You know, there was just this period. Well, you know, people are going to understand. People know all of that stuff. Even our students know. And recently at SF State, a few years ago, the broadcast department, through faculty members who are my friends, they started the media literacy minor, and that program is growing. And I think that there really is this desire to really understand the media for what it is and how it's, you know, how it comes together, and knowing it from a point of knowledge as opposed to not sure, naivete, and all that kind of stuff. So you've got a winner.
I hope so. I mean, intelligence is always going to be attractive, I guess I would say. Like, that's why we're actually introducing sort of gamified levels into the app, because we think about like how, of course, you always want to make an app like fun to use. And that's why like Duolingo has gamification. But hopefully we don't annoy users as much as apparently Duolingo annoys users, because a lot of reminders used to stress me out. But the idea being like, wait, what we're actually kind of celebrating people's ability to do on Impress is like, you're well-read. That's basically what it is. And so we're like introducing levels that are like, you know, you might be a novice at first, but then you're a student and a scholar. That's what you really get to show off, is like, hey, I actually know what's happening in the world and I engage with facts. It's weird now. We live in a world where that would be something that wouldn't be a given.
Yeah. All right. So as we start to wrap things up, I would like to ask you, Adam, about the future. And I usually ask this question, and most people will tell me, Yumi, we don't even know what's going on next month, okay? And I get it. So you can choose. Are we looking at next year, 5 years?
Yeah, I'll do the next year, and then I'll do like 5 years. Let's skip a big time lap there. So basically, Yeah, so we're launched. You know, obviously we're available in DC right now, and we are going to launch, and I won't say exactly which city next, but we have another city on the docket. We are in the just wrapped up our friends and family pre-seed round, and we're going to move on to another seed investment round in the nearish future, which will basically help us pull that off. We hope to be nationwide in the not so distant future, not the 5-year future, a lot sooner than that. And I think at a high level, what I would mention for a journalistic audience is that what we're really trying to do, and my ultimate vision, as lofty and amorphous as it may be, is with our different revenue models that we have, we do actually have the ability to make tech money, right? Like our ad revenue, our anonymized data, our premium subscriptions. This is not just a journalism economy that we're in. And we are reserving a part of our premium revenues for the outlets that partner with us. Now, bear in mind that only outlets who statistically are shown to be factual are allowed on Impress. So if we're saving that slice of that pie for those outlets, we're only driving additional revenue for accountable players. The idea being that as we start to make tech money, we basically can start to make facts more profitable than fiction and rage in journalism, changing the calculus of where the motivation to report is, less clickbaity headlines and selling out for paywalls and ads, and more just give the people what they want and make more money for it. Like that's kind of just do the right thing that we as journalists want to do. We don't want to make our journalism less accessible, and we don't want to drown it in ads either. we just want people to enjoy it. So that's what we're trying to basically do in a kind of roundabout way. And I guess the last thing I would say as long-term goal in the future is that people will sometimes ask, why don't you just launch this everywhere or even in like smaller towns? And frankly, you know, network reliant has to be some population density to kick things off. But I'd like to remind them of kind of how Uber works, which is it was very weird and obtuse to people at first. And a lot of people had a knee-jerk reaction against it. But after it normalizes in big cities, it expands to more rural parts of the country and the world. And then all of a sudden, it's part of the greater diaspora. And I think that as Impress starts to do that, that my hope and vision is that people come from places like where I come from, rural Ohio, for instance, that maybe they don't know what the AP is, maybe they don't know what The Economist is, but they heard about how their cousins and friends in San Francisco and New York found the love of their life or their best friend from this tool. And so they're like, I don't know what the AP is, but yeah, I'll read this article because I'm here for the outcome. That slowly but surely, we basically start to bring everybody back to a shared reality. And we just give them a really wholesome, fun reason to do that. And it's going to take a while before we get there, but that's what I think the future holds. And that's the future that we're working towards.
That is exciting. And, you know, once it gets to San Francisco, you know, I'll definitely check it out, even though I don't really need to date because I'm married. But, you know, hey, what about that? No, I'm just kidding.
I'll have you know, our female friends version is the most popular version of the app right now. So,
oh, I love that. That's what I was planning to do. All right. So I want to do and say a couple of actionable takeaways for our listeners. So one takeaway that I heard is this idea that AI is something that can help improve efficiency and make our lives better. Would you agree with that?
I would very much agree with that. Yes.
All right. Number two, that media literacy is sexy.
That's a given.
And the app Impress is really focused on improving media literacy by providing factual news, news that doesn't go one side to the other side, like so much news does. And yeah, I mean, so factual news is key.
That's absolutely right. And it's better for the human connection aspect as well. And I guess the last thing I'll leave with that is that it creates new opportunities to use journalism to connect people in ways that we don't, again, we're just grasping. Like we've introduced the ability to, if you and I, Yumi, were in the same room and we had just met, we're like, oh, you seem interesting into journalism. Let's tap our phones. Like we were adding someone on Apple Contacts. And now all of a sudden we can see our subconscious interests up front, right on our lock screen. And like, oh, you like this band too. And it just in real time. So it's working real life to app to real life. We're basically building compatibility as a service. And journalism is what informs it.
That is amazing. It reminds me of Black Mirror.
Hopefully a more wholesome version, but yeah.
Okay. With that, if you enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to leave a rating on Apple or Spotify, anywhere you hear this show, AI in Journalism. And I do have a newsletter. It's called AI in Journalism, and you can find it at yumiwilson.me. Please subscribe. To everyone who joined in today, thank you for listening to AI in Journalism. I look forward to bringing you more insights on technology's role in the media. And if this episode resonated, connect with me. Let me know what you liked about it and what you'd like to hear more of. Remember, AI in Journalism is here for you to stay informed and stay inspired. Until next time, thank you for tuning in to AI in Journalism. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe and leave a review to help me connect with more journalists, communicators, and educators like you. If you're interested in personalized coaching, a LinkedIn profile makeover, or a resume revamp, visit my website at yumiwilson.me. I'm here to help you advance your career. And if you'd like to support the show, please consider becoming a member on Patreon. Your support helps sustain this program. I'm also open to collaborating with other media professionals and educators exploring AI. So please feel free to reach out. Until next time, stay curious and stay informed.